Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Anne Ball. Later, you will hear the first part of The Diamond Lens by Fitz James O'Brien on American Stories. But first, the top United States commander in Europe is warning of Chinese investment in European ports and increases in Russian submarine activity outside of Europe. Air Force General Todd Walters is commander of U.S. European Command and NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, Europe. He spoke to the U.S. Senate's Armed Services Committee earlier this week. Walters told the committee that China has access to 10% of the shipping rights into and out of Europe. "It is very alarming," he said. "When you control the ability to take in and regulate resources, you have a large impact on what actually exists on the continent with respect to its ability to effectively generate peace and security." Walters added that China has invested an economic majority in seaports across Europe, including in Belgium, Italy, France, and Greece. All four countries are members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The general also expressed concern about the Chinese company Huawei's 5G wireless technology. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper noted the same concerns at a security conference in Munich earlier this month. He warned that China was seeking gains over the United States and its allies in Europe by any means and at any cost. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg also spoke at the Munich meeting. He warned that Western allies should not risk security for short-term economic gains with China. To do so would risk dividing European allies and dividing Europe from America, he said. Walters told the U.S. lawmakers that the use of Huawei's 5G technology is an intelligence threat to U.S. soldiers in Europe. He said that without the right protection, personal and technical information are at risk of being stolen. Last month, Britain decided not to ban Huawei equipment in its new 5G network. But Walters said he was pleased by several other nations' unwillingness to accept Huawei's 5G technology. He warned there must first be a common understanding at the political level at NATO that Chinese economic aggression in Europe is an actual threat. Walters also spoke about Russian submarine activity. He noted that in 2018 and 2019, the U.S. military reported a 50% increase in the number of resources Russia committed to submarine operations outside of Europe. Walters added, "This observation is one more reflection about how important it is to continue to improve our competitive edge to ensure that we can operate with freedom."
The United States Space Agency recently marked the loss of a very important person to America's early space efforts. NASA mathematician Katherine Johnson died earlier this month at the age of 101. She was an African-American woman who is credited with breaking race barriers by working in NASA's early space program. Our NASA family is sad to learn the news that Katherine Johnson passed away this morning at 101 years old. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine wrote on Twitter, "She was an American hero, and her pioneering legacy will never be forgotten," he added. Johnson received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from former President Barack Obama in 2015. At the time, then NASA Administrator Charles Bolden praised Johnson. He said, "She's one of the greatest minds ever to grace our agency or our country." A 2016 book called Hidden Figures was based on her life and experiences. It was turned into a Hollywood movie the same year. The film received 3 Academy Award nominations from the film industry. Johnson attended the Academy Awards ceremony the following year with actors from the film. Johnson and her colleagues were known as human computers during the early years of NASA's efforts to start the space program. They used pencils, slide rules, and mechanical calculating machines to calculate the paths of rockets and orbiters in the atmosphere and in space. Johnson worked on the first mission to put an American in space in 1961. She also confirmed the computer calculations made by IBM computers for orbits of the Earth in 1962. Johnson told the Virginian Pilot newspaper in 2012, "Our office computed all the rocket trajectories." But Johnson and her African-American co-workers were little known by the public until the appearance of the book and movie. One reason is because NASA segregated the group at the Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. In other words, government officials kept the women separate because of the color of their skin. Although she worked in a group separated from white workers, Johnson said that she was too busy to be concerned with racism. Margot Lee Shetterly wrote in her book Hidden Figures that Johnson didn't close her eyes to the racism that existed. She instead willed it out of existence in as much as her daily life was concerned. Johnson grew up in West Virginia at a time when education for African Americans was limited. Her mother and father moved 120 miles to live in a town that had a high school for African-American children. Her skill in mathematics got her into West Virginia State College at the age of 15. She also was one of the first black students to enter the graduate school at West Virginia University in 1938. Later, Johnson went to work for an agency that would become the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, where she worked with other African-American women. She continued with NASA long after the early space flights, working on the Apollo and Space Shuttle programs. She retired in 1986. She said she was most proud of calculating the paths for the lunar lander and the orbiting command spacecraft for the first trip to the moon, Apollo 11. Johnson described her abilities to reporters this way. "You tell me when and where you want it to come down, and I will tell you where and when and how to launch it," she said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Today, we answer a question from Melsum in Iran. How many ways can we say you're welcome? How can we reply to them in both formal and informal ways? Dear Melsum, we thank you for your question. Let's take a look at the formal answers first. These would be ones that you may use with people you do not know very well. They include, "You're very welcome," and "My pleasure." Here's how two coworkers may use them when speaking with each other.
Thank you for helping me finish the project.
Of course, my pleasure.
You may hear "my pleasure" at a popular American fast food restaurant. The company might tell workers to answer with "my pleasure" when people say thank you to them. This is both a formal and kind way to speak. Now, let's look at less formal ways to say you're welcome. They include, "don't mention it," "it was nothing," "sure thing," "anytime," and "no problem." For example, suppose your friend helped you fix a problem with your computer. Here is what the two of you might say.
Thanks for all your help.
No worries. It's not a problem for me.
After saying you're welcome, you can choose to add some of the other expressions, too, like this.
Thanks very much for the ride downtown this morning.
You're welcome. Don't mention it. It was nothing. It is easy for me to take you. I'm happy to help.
And that is Ask a Teacher. I'm Ann Ball.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Diamond Lens. It was written by Fitzjames O'Brien. We will tell the story in two parts. Now, here is Morris Joyce with part one of The Diamond Lens.
When I was 10 years old, one of my older cousins gave me a microscope. The first time I looked through its magic lens, The clouds that surrounded my daily life rolled away. I saw a universe of tiny living creatures in a drop of water. Day after day, night after night, I studied life under my microscope. The fungus that spoiled my mother's jam was, for me, a land of magic gardens. I would put one of those spots of green mold under my microscope and see beautiful forests where strange silver and golden fruit hung from the branches of tiny trees. I felt as if I had discovered another Garden of Eden. Although I didn't tell anyone about my secret world, I decided to spend my life studying the microscope. My parents had other plans for me. When I was nearly 20 years old, they insisted that I learn a profession. Even though we were a rich family, and I really didn't have to work at all, I decided to study medicine in New York. This city was far away from my family, so I could spend my time as I pleased. As long as I paid my medical school fees every year, my family would never know I wasn't attending any classes. In New York, I would be able to buy excellent microscopes and meet scientists from all over the world. I would have plenty of money and plenty of time to spend on my dream. I left home with high hopes. 2 days after I arrived in New York, I found a place to live. It was large enough for me to use one of the rooms as my laboratory. I filled this room with expensive scientific equipment that I did not know how to use. But by the end of my first year in the city, I had become an expert with the microscope. I also had become more and more unhappy. The lens in my expensive microscope was still not strong enough to answer my questions about life. I imagined there were still secrets in nature that the limited power of my equipment prevented me from knowing. I lay awake nights, wishing to find the perfect lens, an instrument of great magnifying power. Such a lens would permit me to see life in the smallest parts of its development. I was sure that a powerful lens like that could be built, and I spent my second year in New York trying to create it. I experimented with every kind of material. I tried simple glass, crystal, and even precious stones, but I always found myself back where I started. My parents were angry at the lack of progress in my medical studies. I had not gone to one class since arriving in New York. Also, I had spent a lot of money on my experiments. One day, while I was working in my laboratory, Jules Simon knocked at my door. He lived in the apartment just above mine. I knew he loved jewelry, expensive clothing, and good living. There was something mysterious about him, too. He always had something to sell, a painting, a rare statue, an expensive pair of lamps. I never understood why Simon did this. He didn't seem to need the money. He had many friends among the best families of New York. Simon was very excited as he came into my laboratory. Oh, my dear fellow, he gasped. I have just seen the most amazing thing in the world. He told me he had gone to visit a woman who had strange magical powers. She could speak to the dead and read the minds of the living. To test her, Simon had written some questions about himself on a piece of paper. The woman, Madame Vulpes, had answered all of the questions correctly. Hearing about this woman gave me an idea. Perhaps she would be able to help me discover the secret of the perfect lens. 2 days later, I went to her house. Madame Vulpes was an ugly woman with sharp, cruel eyes. She didn't say a word to me when she opened the door, but took me right into her living room. We sat down at a large, round table, and she spoke. What do you want from me? I want to speak to a person who died many years before I was born. Put your hands on the table. We sat there for several minutes. The room grew darker and darker, but Madame Vulpes did not turn on any lights. I began to feel a little silly. Then I felt a series of violent knocks. They shook the table, the back of my chair, the floor under my feet, and even the windows. Madame Vulpes smiled. They are very strong tonight. You are lucky. They want you to write down the name of the spirit you wish to talk to. I tore a piece of paper out of my notebook and wrote down a name. I didn't show it to Madame Vulpes. After a moment, Madame Vulpes' hand began to shake so hard the table moved. She said a spirit was now holding her hand and would write me a message. I gave her paper and a pencil. She wrote something and gave the paper to me. The message read, "I am here. Question me." It was signed Leeuwenhoek. I couldn't believe my eyes. The name was the same one I had written on my piece of paper. I was sure that an ignorant woman like Madame Vulpes would not know who Leeuwenhoek was. Why would she know the name of the man who invented the microscope? Quickly, I wrote a question on another piece of paper. How can I create the perfect lens? Leeuwenhoek wrote back, "Find a diamond of 140 carats. Give it a strong electrical charge. The electricity will change the diamond's atoms. From that stone, you can form the perfect lens." I left Madame Vulpes's house in a state of painful excitement. Where would I find a diamond that large? All my family's money could not buy a diamond like that, and even if I had enough money, I knew that such diamonds are very difficult to find. When I came home, I saw a light in Simon's window. I climbed the stairs to his apartment and went in without knocking. Simon's back was toward me as he bent over a lamp. He looked as if he were carefully studying a small object in his hands. As soon as he heard me enter, he put the object in his pocket. His face became red, and he seemed very nervous. "What are you looking at?" I asked. Simon didn't answer me. Instead, he laughed nervously and told me to sit down. I couldn't wait to tell him my news. "Simon, I have just come from Madame Volpe's. She gave me some important information that will help me find the perfect lens. If only I could find a diamond that weighs 140 carats. My words seemed to change Simon into a wild animal. He rushed to a small table and grabbed a long, thin knife. "No," he shouted. "You won't get my treasure. I'll die before I give it to you." "My dear Simon," I said, "I don't know what you are talking about. I went to Madame Volpe's to ask her for help with a scientific problem. She told me I needed an enormous diamond. You could not possibly own a diamond that large. If you did, you would be very rich, and you wouldn't be living here." He stared at me for a second, and then he laughed and apologized. "Simon," I suggested, "let us drink some wine and forget all this. I have two bottles downstairs in my apartment. What do you think?" "I like your idea," he said. I brought the wine to his apartment, and we began to drink. By the time we had finished the first bottle, Simon was very sleepy and very drunk. I felt as calm as ever, for I believed that I knew Simon's secret.
Just heard part one of The Diamond Lens by Fitzjames O'Brien. Your storyteller was Morris Joyce. Listen again next week for the final part of our story told in special English on The Voice of America. This is Shirley Griffith.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.